You're tuned to the Curb Your Dogma podcast. And now, here is your dangerously underqualified host, Dr. Maury Robertson.
If you haven't picked it up already, I'm conflicted about church. It wouldn't be a big deal if it was just all bad. I would kick it to the curb and move on. But it's not so simple. I'll try to untangle the knot in today's episode. If church is so bad, why is it so full of good? I began this summer series by giving you seven reasons why I found it necessary to leave the church. And then 2 weeks ago, I showed that the word church is actually a very good word not found in the Bible to describe an institution also not found in the Bible. And then last week, I offered a definition of ecclesia that I consider in line with Jesus' intent. Now, church is just a tough subject for me because, well, frankly, it would be easy if it was just all bad. But church has been the source of great blessing in my life. For example, my family. Church is an important part of my family identity. It goes back as far as we can trace. And my friends. I made my closest friends in church. These are good people. These are my high school and college buddies who have been faithful to me over years and decades. And then there's music. I love church music. Everything from Palestrina to Bach to Rutter to the old hymns. I love church music. And education. I owe my education to my denomination. I probably should mention income. For 20 years, the church fed my family and paid my mortgage. And then there's the fact that just driving around in the eastern United States, I love these old church buildings. And when we were in Italy, the cathedrals made my heart soar. And then there's just the fact that the church does a lot of good in the world. Earlier this summer, I was bit by a tick. Guess where I wound up? In a church hospital. So when I talk about leaving church, I kind of get a knot in my stomach. How can I throw all that away? Church may not be a perfect vessel, but it carries the holy. Surely I shouldn't throw out the baby with the bathwater. But in this case, the bathwater has been mixed with the baby for so long that it's hard to tell the two apart. In fact, we don't even call it bathwater anymore. We call it holy water. But bathwater is not holy, and babies were never meant to live in bathwater. Bathwater is meant to be drained, and regularly. Unfortunately, we haven't had a good draining for centuries. The water is so polluted that it's choking the baby. If ecclesia is to thrive in the new millennium, we must find a way to separate the two. But is it possible to separate all the good things that I just described from the church? Yes. In fact, they will be stronger without it. These good things were never the product of church in the first place. They are ecclesia. They have always been ecclesia. The church is like mistletoe. It has attached itself to God's ecclesia and so completely covered it that we think the church is ecclesia. Today, I want to focus on those seven things that I just mentioned: Christian heritage, friends, music, education, income, cathedrals, and charity. I'll take them one at a time and try to separate the baby from the bathwater, starting with my Christian heritage. Now, maybe you're a first-generation follower of Jesus, so it might be kind of easy for you to dismiss church, but for me and for many others, church is a part of a family heritage. To leave church doesn't feel like draining bathwater. It feels like spitting on the graves of your ancestors. I love my family. I'm proud of my heritage. My great-grandparents homesteaded in New Mexico. They packed up everything and headed west, and when they reached their promised land, the first thing they did was build a church. My own dad followed suit. When our family moved to the Pacific Northwest, the first thing he did was help build a church. This faithfulness to church filtered down to me and to my own children. So not to attend church feels like I'm rejecting my own family, my own heritage. It helps to remind myself that what I love about my family is their faith. Frankly, my ancestors wouldn't recognize a modern church service. About the time the drums and electric guitars kicked in, they'd run screaming for the doors. See, it's not the form of the faith that is sacred, but the substance. And there was substance in my family's faith. They were honorable people who loved God and were good to their neighbors. They embodied ecclesia. And that's what I want to cling to and honor. I want to honor the courage it took to pack up everything and leave for parts unknown. I want to honor their grit. They faced real hardship trying to scratch out a living in the dry caprock of New Mexico. I want to honor the fact that their lives were defined by joy in hard times and love at all times. When I think about my own children, I can't help but wonder what they will make of their dad, the pastor who dropped out of church. But I decided that, however puzzling this may be to them, I don't want to pass down a legacy of devotion to a dying institution. I want to pass on a legacy of vital connection with the living Christ. When all else fails, it also helps to remember that the failure to honor tradition is one of the main things that got Jesus in trouble. Holding tradition loosely is one of the best ways to follow the Master's example. So when it comes to my family, I'm trying to hold on to ecclesia, but not necessarily church. Now let me talk about my friends. Until 2 years ago, my whole life was lived inside the church, so it's no surprise all my friends were church friends. In fact, it was hard to even imagine what friendship would be like outside of church. But I did run into some problems. Church taught me to view only church people as family. So inside the church were brothers and sisters. Outside the church were lost sheep. Inevitably, relationships with anyone outside the church were shallow. They weren't family. But even within our family, we had problems. Church had a way of dividing us from our friends, often over like fine points of doctrine and church practice and things like that. People weren't as important as the church. The church was sacred. If friendships had to be sacrificed to the church, well, so be it. Ecclesia's understanding of friendship comes as a relief. Remember, ecclesia is the love of God calling all things to oneness with Himself and harmony with each other. Since God's love is the center of all things, there's just one human family. I can rightly call anyone brother or sister and treat them accordingly. And since God never closes the door on a member of His family, I'm never justified in writing another person off. I'm told to be like my Heavenly Father, who sends the rain and sunshine on His good and bad children alike. I must love and not be choosy about it. I must forgive without counting how many times I've forgiven. Rather than packing up on Sunday morning to go meet with my true family at church, I can walk across the street and get to know my family across the street. See, church family only extends to the limits of its doctrine. If you leave a church, it stresses your friendships. People don't know what to do with you. Your definition of family may include them, but theirs no longer includes you. You've crossed from friend to missions project. So for me, holding on to ecclesia and letting go of church has been very liberating when it comes to my friendships. Although I have to confess, it's been painful with regard to some of my church friends because they've had no choice but to write me off. But let's turn our attention from that dark note to something brighter, music. When Julie and I were in Savannah, Georgia, there was a free concert at the Cathedral of St. John the Baptist. It was a stunning building with perfect acoustics for the antiphonal choir that sang Allegri's Miserere. I loved it. But as a church dropout, I have to confess, I wondered if I was being a hypocrite. How could I sit there feasting my soul on the stained glass light and ethereal music? Hadn't I forfeited my rights to do such things when I dropped out of church? As I thought about it, it hit me that the crowd that was gathered for the music that night included people from many faiths. I would venture to say I was the only former Baptist preacher there, for example. When the music began, creeds meant nothing. In the presence of the glory of the music, we felt the love of God, calling all things to oneness with Himself and harmony with each other. We felt ecclesia. It wasn't Catholic or Baptist or Lutheran or agnostic or atheist or anything. It was heavenly. Music conveys the invisible God to the human soul. It is universal language. In its presence, we are powerless to deny that we are a single human family, where there is no Jew or Greek, slave nor free, male nor female. We are all one in Christ Jesus. It's a mistake to define any music as, quote, church music. You might as well try to define church air or church water or church sky. Even worse, when we cordon off some set of music and proclaim it sacred, we imply that the rest is profane. That's why, as a pastor, music was not the source of joy for me. It was the fountain of grief, because what exactly constitute legitimate, quote, church music? Organs? Pianos? Choirs? Drums? Electric guitars? Ancient hymns? Modern choruses? People get uptight about this stuff. And actually, that kind of makes sense if the Christian life is defined as church, and church is defined as the Sunday morning worship. Now, of course, most churches would say, oh, we're so much more than just our Sunday morning worship, but frankly, that's really 80% of it. And there's only so much time for so much music on a Sunday morning. Choices have to be made. The choices draw lines. Music defines us. If you don't sing my kind of music, you're not my kind of person. And that's why church is the single most segregated hour of the week. We don't all like the same tunes. But if ecclesia is a way of life, not a Sunday morning experience, and if God's love reaches every created thing, then all people and all kinds of music are sacred. We can be one glorious family singing an endless variety of songs around the throne. A fourth blessing that was conveyed to my life through church was my education. I thank God for my seminary education and the passionate teachers who helped shape my life there. But my seminary, like most seminaries, was owned by a church. And as a tool of the church, it had a carefully defined system of beliefs. In spite of statements to the contrary, my school did not exist to freely pursue truth. It existed to defend its position and steep its students in its doctrines. I felt this when I became a professor. I had to sign a document promising to keep my teaching in bounds. Ultimately, I found that to be too restrictive. It's one of the reasons I had to step out. But if there was no church, how would people learn? Would there be seminaries? Yes. Traditional education is undergoing a revolution. Educational institutions used to be repositories of information. You went to school because that was where the information was. Now, information has flown the ivory tower and is available to anyone who can do a Google search. This wild west of education may threaten the church and traditional institutions, but it's a perfect fit for ecclesia. Ecclesia loves wideness. Just as there is no such thing as Christian music, there's no such thing as, quote, Christian education. Each person is free to seek the knowledge they crave, trusting love to hold us together and believing we're pursuing the same center even though we may be on different paths. No doubt there will always be church-owned seminaries, but maybe some seminaries will spring from ecclesia too. I'd love to see that. A school like that would find its center in the love of God and leave room for diversity. It wouldn't train people to serve a church, but to love a neighbor. But by far, to me, the most exciting development in education is the rise of individuals teaching the things they're passionate about. Just as the record industry and the film industry and the publishing industry have exploded their institutional forms, so education is exploding its traditional form. Today, any good teacher can gather up a class and have at it. I've experienced this firsthand. I developed an extensive online course for learning biblical Greek, and hundreds of students are taking advantage of this. But you don't have to be an expert in Greek. Everyone can do this. As a poster my wife has on her mirror proclaims, "Teach everything you know." So I believe that education can thrive in ecclesia, and that there really is no need for church to do this. A fifth blessing of church to my life personally was just plain old greenbacks, money, income, dollars, moolah. What will become of all the paid church workers if there's no church? Will they be out on their ear? Not necessarily. In fact, they may thrive. There was a day when being a pastor was a prestigious role. I remember when golf courses let me play free because I was a pastor. Those days are gone. Now they're more likely to charge me double. They assume since I'm a pastor, I'm a charlatan. If you're thinking about becoming a minister, let me give you a little preview of what you're in for. You'll start by attending about as much school as doctors, lawyers, and rocket scientists. Next, you'll throw your hat in the ring with a bunch of other pastors, hoping to be hired by one of the few churches that can still afford to pay you a salary, sort of. If you're lucky enough to be interviewed, you'll get grilled by the board and the congregation. If you pass all this, you're it. You'll be given a job description that our Lord himself could not fulfill. Actually, you'll be given dozens of job descriptions, one from each church member. Everyone has a different idea of what a pastor should be. Plan on regularly disappointing people and making a few people hoppin' mad. If after a while you decide you want to do something else, you'll discover that listing pastor on your resume won't help you. Most people will assume there's something wrong with you. Weren't you called by God? Why did you quit? What if we abandoned this narrow understanding of church and pastor and assumed that ecclesia is the love of God calling all things to oneness with himself and harmony with each other? There's room in this world for mechanics and doctors and storekeepers. Why not room for people who specialize in matters of the soul? In fact, people are starving for this. They're gobbling up all kinds of books that promise to help them find meaning or purpose or direction for their lives. Usually these are found in the self-help section. What is noticeably absent from these books is any kind of Christian voice. That's because the Christian message is not, here's a way of life Jesus taught. The Christian message is, go to church. If, like me, you're a Christian professional who's left the church, I have a soft spot in my heart for you. I know how hard that is. But you have gifts. The trick is to find a way to offer those gifts to the people who need them. If you do this, you'll never go hungry. People are generous. They will open their wallets and bless you when you meet a need in their life. Maybe like me, you'll find the online platform is a way to do this, but if that's not your thing, there are abundant opportunities in the face-to-face world as well. When you find a place to plug in, you might discover you're more alive to God than ever before and more useful to people. You're no longer the pastor of a church. You're part of God's ecclesia. It is a bigger, brighter, more generous world. Now let's talk about those beautiful church buildings. That's the sixth thing I want to cover today. In Florence, Italy, Julie and I stood in awe of a massive cathedral called the Duomo. Looking up at the vast ceiling, it was impossible not to feel the grandeur of God. But I was conflicted because the art on the ceiling depicted Jesus casting hordes of people into eternal flames, and where they were tormented by demons. Circling the top of the Duomo, even higher on the picture than God, were portraits of the patrons who had given big donations for the building of the big church. It was a dizzying mix of piety and propaganda. I feel the same ambivalence when we drive through the southeastern United States. The landscape is dotted with these beautiful, quaint churches. Usually they're like off in some little valley with a steeple sticking up. They're beautiful. A lot of them were built hundreds of years ago. They look like little slices of heaven. But as a pastor, I know that the insides of those buildings are kind of like the Duomo, a mixed bag. There, friendships are made. God is worshiped. People are taught to live better lives, but also lines are drawn between insiders and outsiders. Friendships are shattered, and the building itself is a big drain on people's wallets. The skyline of Charleston, South Carolina is defined by steeples. It's so pretty. It's not a bunch of skyscrapers. It's all these steeples sticking up. It's so pretty. The mass of steeples in Charleston is a symbol of the city's tradition of religious tolerance. But it also raises a question. In a medieval village, there was one church and one steeple that stood for the one God and the one government. It was simple, clear, straightforward, clear, right? In Charleston, whose church has the real God? The Christians in the New Testament never built a building and put a steeple over it or slapped a name on it. You see, because the moment you section something off and give it a name, it takes on independent existence, and its greatest concern, its prime directive, is its own survival, and it becomes inevitably us against them. Churches can't help but be partisan. But ecclesia is very different. The ceiling of ecclesia is the sky. It stands over all churches and all steeples and all things. God does not dwell in buildings made with human hands. And by the way, a building can be an expression of ecclesia without being a, quote, church. Icons like the Golden Gate Bridge or the Eiffel Tower or the Space Needle or even like Fenway Park, they remind us of our common humanity. They bring people together and help us remember that underneath the surface, we're one human family. Take me out to the ballpark. I mean, we sing that together and we feel a oneness, don't we? Deeper and more broad and more wide than we feel in church. That should tell us something. And lest we get too enamored with any sacred building, it's good to remember Jesus' words about the Jewish temple. They were walking out past the temple, and one of the disciples said to Jesus, "Teacher, behold, what wonderful stones and what wonderful buildings." And Jesus said to him, "Do you see these great buildings? Not one stone will be left upon another which will not be torn down." Jesus destroyed the temple. Buildings, like any human art, can reflect the glory of God. They must never replace it. Seventh and last, what about charity? Doesn't the church do a lot of good in the world? What about that hospital I went to that took care of me when I got bit by a tick? Doesn't the church care for the poor? Well, actually, only a tiny fraction of a church's budget goes to charity. Most gets gobbled up by the maintenance of its own building and organization. Of the $50-plus billion given every year to churches, very little winds up helping the poor. Also, charity work done by churches usually comes with strings attached. There's an agenda. The goal is to meet a human need, yes, but kind of with the idea of trying to lure them into the church. The early Christians were not known for trying to lure anybody into an organization. They were known for their love. For example, they would rescue abandoned infants and adopt them. They didn't do this in the name of church. They did it in the name of Jesus, in the name of love. The best charity work is always accomplished by the person who meets the need of the person standing right in front of them. So yes, charity will be just fine without the church. In fact, if we were to embrace the idea of ecclesia, charity would thrive. So to wrap this up, if the church is so bad, why is it so full of good? Because the church has attached itself to God's ecclesia. And it's been that way for so long that we can't imagine the one without the other. Many good things have come down to us by means of this amalgam of church and ecclesia. The question is whether the amalgam is necessary. Would all the good things that I've been talking about in this episode have been possible without the church? Absolutely. Church is not the source of any of those things. In our culture, the church and ecclesia always come to the party as a couple, but only the ecclesia comes bearing gifts. So, is church bad? Well, that's like asking if apples are bad. It depends on the apple. The church is a human institution, like any other human institution. Some are better than others. In good churches, the focus is on ecclesia. There's freedom. The work of God is highlighted. The institution is minimized. And there are plenty of churches like that. In bad churches, the human organization restricts human freedom and actually takes on the role of God in people's lives. But I am convinced that the best church is no church. God's ecclesia was never meant to have walls. Jesus described an ecclesia that would flatten even the walls of hell and set the captives free. And that happens best when it happens without human manipulation, in the sacred encounter between a person and her Maker. Each soul must turn its heart to heaven, receive the love of God, and pour that love out to the world. In other words, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself. When you do this, you're part of God's ecclesia. No church is necessary. Now, next week, I want to back up and just share with you one of my greatest struggles that I encountered when I left church. What would I do with the Lord's Supper and baptism? What about marriage and funerals and all these things that the church does? How would people get married? How would they get baptized? Where would they celebrate the Lord's Supper? And what gives me the right to say, you don't have to go to church? Don't I need proper authorization? I want to look at how the church has claimed exclusive authority to do certain things and how it has used these things to manipulate people. And that's what we'll turn our attention to next week in an episode I've called Baptism, the Lord's Supper, and Other Power Plays. See you then.
You can find the show notes and much more at curbyourdogmapodcast.com. If you enjoyed the show, please tell a friend and add Curb Your Dogma to your RSS feed or iTunes. Curb Your Dogma is part of anchorpoint.org. For a free strategy to discover wholeness by following the seven core teachings of Jesus, go to anchorpoint.org.